Sometimes there are things in life which capture the national imagination, and sometimes not only nationally, but also internationally. And one of the things that that can be true of is court trials. By coincidence, just right now, at the moment, the BBC Two is running a series entitled The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. And basically, that's a series looking at the famous or perhaps infamous trial of O.J. Simpson all those years ago. Did he do it? Did he not do it? I don't know. Maybe you should watch the television series and find out, okay? But when that trial was on, it had basically international coverage. Or if you think of the Oscar Pistorius trial, which happened in South Africa, but was like kind of top item on news bulletins all across the planet when it was going on. And just in the last week or so, he has had his leave to appeal refused, and he's now waiting resentencing on the charge of murder for the death of his girlfriend. And let's face it, Northern Ireland has had its fair share of high-profile trials over the years as well. Jesus faced three trial processes in the last hours of his life. He had a trial before the Sanhedrin, which was the highest assembly among the people of Israel, his own nation. He had a trial before Herod, who was the puppet king appointed by the Romans to rule Judea. And he had a trial before Pilate, who was the Roman governor. And we're going to look at these trials that Jesus endured over the next couple of weeks. And on Sundays and on Good Friday, and also on Easter Sunday, we're going to look at a fourth trial, which was even bigger than the first three. And in reality, as we look at these trials together, we're going to discover that, especially in the ones in court, nobody comes out very well except for Jesus. Key thing to remember, however, is that more than just legal process is going on here. Our theme for this year is kingdoms, and we've been using that theme to investigate the idea that in Jesus of Nazareth, the kingdom of heaven is breaking into the world of time and space. In his life, the power of that kingdom was made manifest day after day after day. The sick were healed. Those who were captives were freed. The dead were raised. Incredible things were happening all around the ministry of Jesus as the power of the kingdom of heaven broke into this world. The problem was that no other kingdom was comfortable with the manifestation of the reality of the kingdom of heaven. And so you have a clash of kingdoms. And that's what we want to look at in these trials, because that's what they really were. We've titled this series Battle Royal. There's a war is going on here during these trials between the kingdoms, between the kingdom of heaven that is breaking in and manifesting itself in the life of Jesus and the kingdoms that surround him in Judea in his day. I'm going to look at each one of them plus a fourth trial over these next few weeks. And we start with the trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin. We believe that the Sanhedrin, which was the chief assembly in Judaism, normally met in the temple complex, perhaps in the room which was called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. That assembly consisted of over 70 people who normally sat in a circle with the high priest in the center. The high priest himself, like the moderator of a general assembly of our denomination, was appointed once a year and served for a year. And just like the moderator of the general assembly, even after you cease to be the high priest, you continue to be a person of influence among your people. So, for example, at the time of Jesus' trial, the high priest was a guy called Caiaphas. The high priest in the previous year was a guy called Annas, who was Caiaphas' father-in-law. And part of Jesus' trial probably took place in Annas' home, which proves that Annas was still, even though he was no longer chief priest, highly influential, powerful person in Israel when his son-in-law took over as chief priest. The selection of those who were high priests took place from amongst the priestly families, and many of those families were wealthy and influential. As I've already said, at least part of Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin took place in Annas' home. Now, it took place in the middle of the night. It wasn't called in the normal way, so almost certainly all the members of the Sanhedrin weren't present. But let's say there were 35 or 40 people there. Annas' home was big enough to have a meeting with about 40 people in it, plus the Jewish police who had arrested Jesus and a whole pile of other hangers-on who came with them. So from that, we understand that Annas was a wealthy man. He lived in a large house. And that's the kind of picture of what the Sanhedrin was. And we might expect that Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin is going to be the least difficult one for him. It's going to be easier than the trial before Herod and the trial before Pilate because, of course, the trial before the Sanhedrin was Jesus' trial before the religious establishment of his own people. The court consists of priests, elders, scribes, and the high priest himself, all devout, highly respected men. Surely here, above all other places, Jesus will get a hearing. The reality, however, was that Jesus' first trial, which was his trial before the Sanhedrin, was not a trial at all. It was a travesty. Here's the record of it in Matthew chapter 14, verse 53. The words will come up on screen. They took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build another not made with hands. Yet even then their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses, he asked. You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. And the Lord will bless his truth to our hearts for Christ's sake. The trial wasn't a trial, it was a travesty. Firstly, because it wasn't really a trial at all. The purpose of any trial before any court of law is to examine testimony to see what is true and what is false about the accused. And there's a forensic process that goes on as witnesses are heard and then cross-examined, and a judge or a panel of judges or a jury is given time to reflect on what they have heard and to come to a decision. But none of this was true of Jesus' trial. We read in Mark 14, 55, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. The reality was that the Jewish establishment, and we're talking about religious leaders here. We're not talking about politicians, okay? We're talking about religious leaders. And they had made their minds up before the trial started that Jesus was guilty. They just had to find a way to get a conviction. The day that it was reported that Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead, we read in John 11 and 53, so from that day on, they, that is the religious leaders of Judaism, they plotted to take Jesus' life. The trial was not even a trial at all. Secondly, the assembly itself was probably illegal. We don't know all the details of the legal procedures in Israel in Jesus' day, but we do know what the practices were within Judaism 2 or 3 centuries later. And because Judaism in itself was quite a conservative form of faith and culture, it is highly likely that what we know for certain about a couple of centuries later was almost certainly true in Jesus' day as well. And by those standards, what do we know? What we know is that, for example, calling a meeting of the Sanhedrin secretly was illegal. Calling a meeting of the Sanhedrin without proper notice was illegal. Calling a Sanhedrin and holding it at night was illegal. Calling a Sanhedrin meeting in the high priest's home was illegal. All of these things were illegal. So the assembly itself had no standing legally. Thirdly, the verdict of the assembly was unsustainable. When the court met, the usual procedures were attempted. Jewish legal processes were not dissimilar to our own. What happened was that the accused would be brought in, the charge would be laid against him, and then witnesses would be produced for or against the charge. And those witnesses would be cross-examined, they would be questioned in detail, and an attempt would be made to arrive at whether or not the witnesses were telling the truth and whether what the witnesses said substantiated the charge that was against the accused. It's just the way it operates in almost any other court in the world. What happened here? What happened here was a disaster legally. On two occasions in those verses we read from Mark chapter 14, we read this. In verse 56, for example, many testified falsely against Jesus, but their statements did not agree. And then a few verses later, and then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. Yet even then, their testimony did not agree. The witnesses who were called in court, their stories didn't square up. Now, because of that, two things should have happened. The first thing that should have happened was this. The first thing that should have happened was that the charges against Jesus should have been dropped and he should have been allowed to walk out of the court a free man because the witnesses were unable to substantiate the charges. In fact, the witnesses disagreed with each other. That's the first thing. Second thing that should have happened was this. This was a capital trial. Jesus head was on the block. The one possible outcome of what the court might decide was that Jesus could be put to death. So it was a capital trial on a capital offense. And the Old Testament scriptures say that in a capital trial where the witnesses lie, the witnesses should be put to death. So what should have happened that day was that Jesus should have been set free and the people who gave false witness against him should have been put to death. But neither of those things happened. Instead, the high priest questions Jesus. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Now, one of the rules of a Jewish court was that you were not required to condemn yourself. So a direct question like this, whatever way Jesus answered this question, was likely to make him guilty, and so he was not required to answer the question. Here's the amazing thing about the story of this trial. All the other questions that Jesus was asked, he refused to answer. The one question he didn't have to answer, he could not be required to answer, was the one question he did answer. Jesus replied, "I am," he said, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." And the moment Jesus said that, the high priest calls out, "Blasphemy!" In other words, he has condemned himself out of his own mouth, which strictly speaking in a Jewish court, he shouldn't have been able to do. But anyway, blasphemy. Now, in reality, Jesus had not committed blasphemy. He had not used the divine name for himself or even mentioned it. What he did was he quoted from Daniel chapter 7, where the prophet says, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Now, if you heard Jesus alluded to this prophecy, and the implication of what Jesus said was that this prophecy was about him. This is a man standing in a court of law, bound. He has no rights. He holds no power and authority. He looks nothing like the person described in this prophecy, whom the whole world worshipped and whose dominion was an everlasting dominion that would never end. If you heard somebody say this, you would be more inclined to think that they were insane rather than they were a blasphemer. The high priest calls out blasphemy, and then he asks the court for a verdict. And apparently what they did in the Sanhedrin was this. You didn't get to get a little bit of paper that you scribbled your vote on and was collected up and counted privately. Each person was asked to respond individually. They need to get up to their feet and say what the verdict was. And the high priest went around the room one at a time, every single one of them, asked them for their verdict. Apparently, they started from the youngest in the room and went through to the oldest so that the opinion of the oldest would not adversely influence the youngest. And the high priest went around the room, every single one of them, individually, and every single one of them said, guilty. The reality was the court proceedings did not substantiate the case. It was a farce. The last thing was this. They compounded their injustice with violence. Then some began to spit at him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists and said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. All of this behavior was illegal in a Jewish court. It was, in fact, barbaric. How could faith leaders do this? These were not military commanders. These were not policemen. These were not politicians. These were religious leaders spitting, attacking, handing Jesus over so that he might be beaten. How could they do it? Life situations sometimes lay bare the darkness of human hearts. I read a sad story in the Telegraph yesterday. I don't know, maybe you heard it too. I didn't remember this story from the 1970s, but it was the story of Private Gary Barlow, who at 19 years of age was a private in the army here in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. In 1973, he was sent out with a detachment of soldiers to carry out a search in Devis Flats. And he got separated from his comrades. And he was cornered in an alleyway by a group of women who held him there until a provisional IRA gunman could come along and shoot him dead. And you think to yourself, how could they do that? How could it be that a group of women could have no form of human compassion for a young man who was lost, alone, petrified, no doubt, cornered in an alleyway, waiting for what would be his inevitable end. And nobody had any sympathy for him. How could they do that? Here is Jesus Christ, okay? The only Son of the living God. Perfect, beautiful, incredible life. And they spat at him. They punched him in the face. They handed him over to be beaten. How could they do that? How could they do that? But they did. What do we learn from this so-called trial? Two things. The kingdom of heaven has to be revealed to you. You can't see it for yourself. Sanhedrin consisted of the guardians of the Jewish faith, the priests, the elders, scribes. And yet, religious men though they were, the first time they met to consider the case of Jesus, which is recorded for us in John chapter 11, they concluded that Jesus needed to die. We read in John 11, therefore many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary, this was after Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead, many of the Jews who had come had seen what Jesus did and believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests of the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all, he said. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perished. These religious leaders could not see what was staring them in the face. Just a matter of hours before this court was called to assemble, a man whom they all knew, everybody knew, who lived in Bethany, who was dead. Everybody knew he was dead. The half of Jerusalem was at his funeral. Jesus had gone to his tomb days after he died and had called him alive again. And this same Jesus who had just done this was the person whose case they were considering in the Sanhedrin, and they were debating how they could put him to death after this. How on earth could they do that? Why could they not see what was staring them in the face? There's a kind of an irony in Mark's gospel in those verses we read earlier in the service in Mark chapter 14. Where in that reading, at the end of it, when they are beating Jesus and spitting at him and punching him in the face, and they're saying, prophesy, Matthew tells us in his gospel that what they meant by that was that as some of the Jesus was blindfolded, so as they struck him in the face and shouted at him, prophesy, what they meant was, tell us who it was that hit you. You know, if you're really a prophet, like if you're really from God, then even though you're blindfolded, you'll still know who did it. They were trying to demonstrate that Jesus was called a prophet, but really he was no prophet at all. Here's the irony. Here's the irony. The same time those things were happening inside the room, outside that room in the courtyard was Peter, one of Jesus' closest friends, warming himself by the fire. And he's challenged by a servant girl who's in the courtyard to say that he is one of Jesus' disciples, and he denies it three times. Fulfilling the word of prophecy that Jesus had spoken to him a few hours earlier that evening when he said that before the cock crows tomorrow morning, you will have denied me three times, and thereby demonstrating, according to the test given to the Israelites by Moses hundreds of years before this, that he was a true prophet of Israel, for the words that he had said came true and were coming true outside in the courtyard while these people were spitting on him and mocking him inside. They couldn't see what was staring them in the face. So should we excuse these Jewish leaders for their blindness? If you just can't see what the kingdom of God is doing with your natural eyesight, if it has to be revealed to you, then should we let them off the hook? Should we say, well, they're not really guilty because they didn't receive divine revelation, so it was hardly their fault? Really? Because here's the funny thing. The funny thing is that in the scripture, the people who want to see it, see it. Old Simeon, waiting in the temple courts because he got a promise. And he lived by that promise. So God had said to him, you're not going to die till you see the Messiah. And he was in the temple court that day when this young couple came in with their child. They didn't look any different from the thousands of other young couples coming into the temple that he had seen over the years, that he had waited for the fulfillment of the promise. Here they came, the baby in their arms, 10 days old, little boy. Didn't look any different from many of the other boys who came in with their parents. At that time in Jesus' life, he hadn't walked on water. He hadn't changed water into wine. He hadn't called Lazarus out of the tomb. He hadn't stilled the storms. He hadn't put his hands on the eyes of the blind and made them see. He was a child in his mother's arms. The only thing he did was feed and dirty a nappy. And yet Simeon looked at him and he said to God, Lord, now let your servant depart in peace because my eyes have seen the glory of God. All his life, it's all he had wanted to see. He had given his life to it. He had lived in the temple courts. He had waited for the fulfillment to him of the promise that he believed the Lord had given him. And when Jesus walked in, he saw him for who he was. He saw because he wanted to see. The problem for the Jewish leaders was what their minds were fixated on. In John 11:48, they said, if we let him, Jesus, go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. See, it didn't seem to matter to these people whether Jesus was right or wrong. That was completely irrelevant. What mattered was that what he was doing was bringing the status quo under threat, and they didn't want to see beyond that. We will lose the temple. We will lose the nation if this character Jesus goes on saying and doing the things that he is saying and doing. Therefore, he must die so that the temple and the nation can be preserved. They didn't want the kingdom of heaven to be manifest. They just didn't want what they had to change. They didn't see because they didn't want to see. It's a dangerous, dangerous place to be in your life. I get emails and messages sometimes from people, ministers sometimes, Christian leaders in other churches, who want to talk to me about things like healing. Does it really happen today? Prophecy. Is there any such thing as prophecy? Or didn't it stop years and years ago? Or tongues or things like that. And they want to talk to me about it. Very often I don't meet them. Why do I not meet them? Not because I love conversation. I love talking about these things. They're special to me. But sometimes I don't meet them because I know before I meet them that no matter what I say, they will not believe. They will not accept because they don't want to see. And it's a terrible place to be because it's where the Sanhedrin were that day. They didn't care whether Jesus was true or false. They didn't care whether he was right or wrong. All they cared about was preserving the status quo. They didn't want to see the glory of the kingdom of heaven, and therefore they couldn't see it when the person who had just raised a dead man from the tomb was standing in front of them. We need help to see the kingdom of heaven. It has to be revealed to us. We need to want to see it. How badly do you want to see the glory of God? Here's the second thing. The kingdom of evil is not very smart. The kingdom of evil is not very smart. The religious establishment had surrendered itself to the kingdom of darkness. They had a plan. Their plan was to trap Jesus and catch him out. They tried to do it verbally, first of all, because they would send people out to ask him questions in the hope that when they asked him questions, the answer that he would give would enable him to be charged with something under the law and therefore removed from the public sphere. But that failed. It never worked. So then when they couldn't entrap him in words, they decided to entrap him physically. And so they got themselves an agent inside the band of disciples. They put a guy called Judas on the payroll. And the reason why they did that was because they hoped that at an opportune moment, Judas would deliver Jesus to them on a plate. And then they could arrest him and deal with him. And that, of course, is exactly what happened. What they then did was they gathered various witnesses to give testimony against him. And the whole thing was a total shambles. In fact, if it had not been for the testimony of the accused himself, their strategy would have totally failed. When you read the stories, and the story of this trial before Caiaphas is recorded actually in all four of the Gospels. And if you read that story, there is an abiding impression from reading it, which is that you see what is going on in this courtroom. You see the shambles, you know, the corruption of those who are giving testimony against Jesus, the panic of the Jewish leaders trying to find a way to get a judgment they know they cannot get from the witnesses that are standing in front of them. And then you have Jesus, like the one person who seems calm in the midst of it all, the one person who delivers for them the verdict that they cannot deliver for themselves. I love what Jesus says about the cross. John 10 and 17, the reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father. Jesus doesn't answer a single question that day at the trial except for the one question that he didn't need to answer. And by answering the question that he was not required to answer, he gave the Jewish people what they couldn't do for themselves. He did it. Nobody takes my life from me. I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father. Who's really in charge of Jesus' trial? I also love what John says to the young believers in Ephesus, those in whose lives the Holy Spirit dwells. He says in 1 John 4, verse 4, you, dear children, are from God and have overcome the world because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. We are afraid that the kingdom of darkness is super organized. really efficient, has loads of resources, power, and authority, and large battalions of people and dark angels gathered against the kingdom of light, and that we should be afraid of that. And of course, the New Testament tells us to put on the armor of God. And of course, Peter warns us that our enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. But tell me this, do you think seriously that we should be afraid of a kingdom that can't even get its own story straight? It seems so big, it seems so powerful, we seem so small and so insignificant. Yet John says the one who is in us is greater than the one who is in the world. The presence of God the Holy Spirit in the life of some one lone individual Christian who maybe doesn't have a lot of faith and has very little influence and very few gifts, the presence of the Holy Spirit in that one life is greater than all the power and authority of the kingdom of darkness. I was watching a nature program on television a couple of weeks ago, and it was about the Arctic. And was talking about a number of different Arctic creatures, including the Arctic tern, which is a small bird which surprisingly enough lives in the Arctic, kind of clues in the name. And so they were doing filming about this, and one of the problems for Arctic terns is they're really small birds and they nest on the ground, and so their young are very vulnerable when they're at an age before they can fly. And it showed a scene in the program where a small Arctic tern chick was nesting on the ground when a polar bear leaves the water and starts to roam about looking for something to eat. The polar bear hasn't eaten for days. He's very hungry. To a polar bear, a small chick like that is a sort of a snack on the way to a main meal. And so the polar bear is making its way towards the chick. The chick makes a bad decision. Seeing the polar bear coming, it decides to make a run for it. This is not a good idea. The chick is very small, little spindly legs, and this massive creature with huge legs is making its way towards it. It need barely increase its step to catch up with the chick. So the chick leaves the nest, starts to run, screaming its head off. Its mum, who is out over the water looking for fish to catch to feed the young, hears the cries of her chick and comes back, flies back over in the direction of the nest, spots the polar bear and dive bombs it. Okay, comes right down in the air, hits the polar bear on the nose. Like the polar bear is covered in really thick fur except for one little spot on the end of its nose, and the bird hits this spot on the end of its nose, goes back up again, dives a second time, hits the same spot, goes up, dives a third time, hits the same spot again. By now the polar bear's face is covered in blood, and what happens? The polar bear turns around and walks away and leaves the chick alone. The commentator in the program said, one of the Arctic's smallest birds chases the Arctic's largest predator. Wow. He that is in you is greater than he that is in the world. It looks like we're done for. It looks like the kingdom of darkness has the upper hand. The reality is, in Jesus' trial, who got the decision? Not the court. Jesus himself. Nobody takes my life from me. I have authority to lay it down and take it up again. I choose the way. I choose the moment. And we have no need to fear the kingdom of darkness. I don't mean we need to be cocky. We need to feel that we just don't need any protection or help. Of course, we need all of that, but we don't need to be afraid of the kingdom of darkness, for he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world.